Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and in the studio today with me is Russell Chianelli. And we're going to be talking to somebody who knows a lot about what goes on in space. We've had a few programs on this topic lately, and from those topics, somebody just mentioned that there was the possibility of mining asteroids for interesting materials. And Russell and I looked at each other and said, well, we better find someone who knows something about this. And so we have. And therefore, our special guest today, who knows all about space and possibly mining of asteroids, is Dr. Martin Elvis, works for the Smithsonian Institute at Harvard University. He's our expert of the week. So, Martin, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Oh, thank you.
Now, before we get into you, your job, what you do, how did you start out knowing that perhaps, or not knowing, that science was an area for you for a career when you were a little nipper?
You can tell from my accent I grew up in England, but you can't tell is I grew up in Birmingham, England, which has a very distinctive accent of its own. And my family were all engineers, including my mum, so everyone thought engineering was the only way to go, which is very normal in Birmingham. But I got excited by books they bought me about dinosaurs and things like that, a book about space. I still have it on my bookshelf here from the age of 12, called The Universe. It was all wonderfully exciting, but I didn't know anything about it, and it's particularly. And then I just went through my schoolwork and got drawn to physics because it was a very strange subject. I mean, physics probably sounds dry to a lot of people, but it's full of mind-bending concepts that I really couldn't understand, like quantum mechanics and relativity and so on.
Yeah, but you didn't do that when you were 12 and 13.
No, that came when I was like 15 or 16.
So quite early.
That was what we did back then. That we had physics automatically in school every year, and I had a very good teacher who introduced me to a couple of popular books on the subject.
Yeah. I had physics in the same environment, you know, but we never got to relativity.
Maybe I'm
older than you.
No, but there was a simple book, believe it or not, by Albert Einstein, which is an introduction to relativity, and it was really fascinating. I'm not sure, I wouldn't say I understood it, but I was fascinated by it, and I thought, well, I'm never going to learn this on my own. I'll have to do it when I go to university.
And so where did you go? Where did you study?
I was the first in my family to go to university, so we didn't know anything about how to apply. So the school put me up to go to Oxford, and it was a hopeless failure.
Well, you hadn't done Latin, probably.
It was all the techniques, you know, because you had to spend a special year mugging up properly, and it was all like a total mystery to me. They said, oh, we've got this wonderful scholarship, and it turned out to be in a college that only did divinity. It wasn't quite the same thing.
Well, it's got plenty of space in it, anyway.
Oh, yeah, well, there you are.
Black holes.
I just wasn't thinking broadly enough. There you go.
Yeah. Actually, I've got to mention here, it's interesting when you say that an American audience predominantly listening, that all your parents were engineers, but you were the first person to go to college.
Yep.
And that really is an interesting feature for most people listening, because 99% of the people listening to this program would think, well, you're an engineer, you've studied, you've gone to college, because that's what people do in North America.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that in Britain
periods of years ago. No, they had all sorts of other qualifications you could get
at
technical colleges, which were very clearly at that time distinct from universities.
So was that on-the-job training?
No, they did some studying, but a lot of on-the-job stuff too. My brother used much more difficult math than I did all through his career, so I was very impressed, but he didn't. He was still a bit in awe of someone who did astronomy, so I let it rest. I didn't bring the subject up too much.
So astronomy was your first choice, and astronomy is where you sort of settled on a career.
Well, because I looked at, when I was graduating, I had no idea I wanted to do research, didn't know what research was, but I wanted to find things out. I was told you did a PhD, and somebody showed me a paper in particle physics, because that was big and exciting, and it had like 200 people on it. I thought, well, there's no chance I'm going to stand out in that crowd. and then it turns out astronomy papers had like 3 people on them, so I thought, oh, that's better.
But when you were a kid, did you just go out and stare at the stars?
Nope. You couldn't do that in Birmingham. It's too bright.
See,
it's also too cloudy.
I was going to say it's the cloudy that's the fire. Yeah. And just to put it in perspective for the people who don't know where Birmingham is, it's sort of the middle of England, and it's the, as you pointed out, it's the engineering hub. It's a lot of industry in the Birmingham area, so it's not an optimal place to be stargazing.
Not really, no.
So anyway, you went to college, you studied astronomy, and I
lucked out again with the famous Oxbridge places. I didn't get into Cambridge for a PhD, luckily. I got into Leicester University, and that's of, you know, relatively speaking, it's about 1% of what Cambridge is. But it turned out to be very lucky timing, because the people in Cambridge were heading for decline in the area I was looking at, whereas the Leicester people were hot shot new guys in this field called X-ray astronomy. And I turned up just at the right moment to not fly a rocket that then failed, but instead work on a satellite which had just gone up. Just the, like the week I arrived, it was incredible timing.
Well, I mean, Leicester's in the news these days for football aficionados as being the team that out
wasn't
of nowhere...
Wasn't that good when I was there?
No, well, they're maybe not very good today either. What goes up must come down.
Brief glory.
Tell us a little bit about X-ray astronomy. What's the big issue there? Why is that? Was that sort of a big, new, exciting area?
Well, it was just about 10 years after the very first rocket had gone up and detected very bright source of X-rays in the sky that no one had predicted. And this is work that got the Nobel Prize many years later for Riccardo Jaconi, who I later worked for over here. And nobody knew what these things were. We kept finding bright things in the sky with pouring out these very high temperature radiation. So the sun is about 6,000 degrees. And in X-rays, to see something in X-rays, it has to be at least 6 million degrees. So you're talking about really hot places in the universe. And people are scratching their heads to find out what that could be. So it turns out a lot of them, black holes with matter pouring down onto them, screaming down incredibly fast, colliding and getting very hot. So when we started doing this survey of the sky in X-rays just to see what was there, we kept finding new things that were emitting X-rays that no one had seen before. So,
and that was the whole point of that, is
that was the whole point, yeah.
Black hole, you can't see it with the normal telescope. You need this X-ray or some other high-energy receptor to be able to see them.
Yeah, that's just get right into the inner places. Yeah.
Who coined the term black hole?
Oh, well, there's a lot of debate about it. It's first in a newspaper article, but people say it was John Wheeler at a conference.
And did you know John Wheeler?
No. I haven't met him, no.
Okay, so well, here we are. We're talking about black holes. You were in at the beginning of their sort of discovery.
So my thing was that people had thought there were these things called active galaxies, and they were known to be somewhat strange, but I discovered that there were enormous amounts of X-rays coming from them, and that those X-rays changed in intensity very quickly. So they must be coming from a very small region. So it made a very strong case for them being black holes.
Why, if they change intensity so rapidly, must they come from a small place?
Right, because the speed of light is quite small. It takes 8 minutes for light to get from the sun. So if you see something, so if there was some explosion on the sun, it would be 8 minutes before we know about it and could react. And so if the whole quasar lights up in the time of 8 minutes, then it must be about... It can't be bigger than the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And we found we found things brightening on that sort of time scale, a bit longer, but about that long.
And what was the rationale that you came up with to explain this?
Well, people talk about an X-ray corona, a very small region just outside the black hole event horizon that gets very hot. But actually, that's a bit like dark matter or dark energy. It's a name that says this place emits X-rays, but it doesn't explain it yet. So, in fact, nobody really knows what causes that even now, so 30 years later or something.
Aren't the black holes actually slowly leaking?
They are, but that's a tiny, tiny, tiny effect and could not produce this huge power that we see. What's happening is the gas is falling down. Surely happening is gas is falling down onto these things, and as it goes down, it swirls around and collides with itself, and that gets very hot. But in fact, it doesn't get X-ray hot. It only gets as hot as the hottest stars, a couple of hundred thousand degrees. That's nowhere near the millions we need. So something else then pumps that energy up to much higher temperatures. We don't understand that mechanism yet.
Okay. Now, at the beginning, I mentioned that you work for the Smithsonian Institute.
Yes,
so tell us, at Harvard, what does the Smithsonian Institute have an interest in terms of black holes?
Well, the mission of the Smithsonian is the increase and diffusion of knowledge. So we are trying to increase it, and things like this program help diffuse it. So that's its total goal. And it's had an astronomical observatory for over 100 years.
Where is that?
That was, well, the observatory was originally in Washington, and somewhere in the 1950s it got down to like two or three old guys, and they had to decide should they reinvigorate it or should they just close it down and say it's a dead loss. Instead, so they decided to contact Professor at Harvard, asked what he thought, and he said, I'll take it over, no problem, but you've got to move it up here to Harvard. So the whole Smithsonian Observatory moved up here, and that was just at the beginning of just before Sputnik went up. And when it went up, that was what the professor was, Fred Whipple, was keen on, and so he became a sensation overnight, and we got huge funds from NASA and the U.S. government to track these dangerous-looking things. So it became a big thing here.
I think you might tell our listeners that the Smithsonian is spread around.
Oh, yeah. In fact, just the Smithsonian Observatory, we're headquartered here in Cambridge, Mass., but we have telescopes in Arizona, in Hawaii, in Chile, in South America, and in space. So we have huge numbers of telescopes. In fact, we have them in Antarctica, too. I've just forgotten that. There we go.
But isn't the Smithsonian headquarters in Washington?
That's correct.
I know I've worked with them on various ores and findings.
Oh, yes. And the main bulk of the Smithsonian is in Washington, absolutely, on the Mall by the Capitol and so on. But they also have research stations in Maryland, the zoo, and then in Panama and in the Amazon and all sorts of places.
And it all came from a Scotsman.
Yes, excellent.
Absolutely. So now let's talk a little bit. What have you been doing in the Smithsonian? What is it that you're earning your bread and butter studying? You started with black holes?
I've been working on black holes for a very long time.
Yes. Right.
But starting out with that discovery that some galaxies have what we now realize is a giant black hole in the center. By giant, I mean a million or even a billion times the mass of our sun.
I'll ask a silly question. Do all galaxies have a black hole in the middle?
Pretty much, yeah. All big ones, with a very few exceptions.
And the exceptions then must point to something fundamental, because it's always the exceptions that scientists like to hone in on. And why do some not have them? Or is this, again, we're talking in the realm of science fiction, we don't know?
Well, slightly, there's some ideas. There's only a few that we are good. We can put a real tight limit on how big a black hole could be there, and there's only a handful of those. So.
But now we have gravity waves.
Oh, yes.
Which are telling us more about black holes.
Yeah, and that's actually relevant. One of the mechanisms for getting rid of a black hole, even a giant one from the center of a galaxy, is to kick it out. And when two black holes merge, there is a small kick. At the last second, or last millisecond even, of that merger process, you've got one merges from one side, and that produces a kick in the same direction for the whole black hole. If that's big enough, it can actually knock the black hole right out of the galaxy. It doesn't happen very often, so you don't expect many like that.
Have you actually observed this?
Have
you
been lucky enough? We have, yes. Right? We think we have.
LIGO.
The merger has been seen with LIGO now, so that's a known process. We know it works. We've actually observed a black hole that seems to have been kicked partway out of its galaxy in a survey I was involved with, the Cosmos survey. My former postdoc, Francesca Civano, did most of that work. And we just see this black hole where it shouldn't be. We call them active nuclei, but this is an active non-nucleus. It's sort of pushed out a bit.
Jolly good. Well, this is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Rush Chianelli. And we're talking to Dr. Martin Elvis from the Smithsonian Institute, working at Harvard University in the Northeast. And we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, Martin Elvis up there at the Harvard University working for the Smithsonian Institute. And we were talking about his sort of initial forays into black holes, lucky enough to be at the University of Leicester or Leicester University at the right time. Now, I do know from reading about you and talking to friends about you that you've got a new interest, and that is this whole, really sounds like science fiction, of mining asteroids and other astronomical units for useful materials. So why don't you start from how you began to think about this and where your thinking and experimentation has led you?
Sure, yeah. Changing from the most distant things in the universe to the nearest ones that could still be called astronomy is kind of a leap, and I haven't done anything in between. But the real thinking was, well, there was a symposium at Stanford a bunch of years ago where someone said, what if NASA were not to go to the moon but to an asteroid? And I thought, well, I wonder how that would help astronomy. And after a bit, I thought, well, that could really help a lot, because a lot of the technology that would be needed would be stuff we don't have now but could help us build bigger and better telescopes in space. In fact, I got to a more dramatic point when I realized that I've enjoyed over 30 years of telescope that span the electromagnetic spectrum. That means going from X-rays and gamma rays to the ultraviolet through the infrared and out towards the millimeter wave bands. And that's lucky because the stars are indifferent to astronomy, as Bandnada Surf say. What that means is that they don't care what our telescopes can do. They just radiate away, and it's up to us to adapt to them. And they radiate all across the spectrum like that.
So your initial idea, perhaps, was to actually place some form of telescope on an asteroid?
No, it was that in order to do something with asteroids, you had to have a lot more capability in space, being able to refuel rockets up in space, build larger structures and that kind of thing, rather than actually putting it on an asteroid. I don't think there's much benefit to that. What I now think is that in order to keep having a complete fleet of telescopes in space, which are the only place we can do most of this astronomy because the atmosphere blocks most of the light, different wavelengths of light getting to us, we have to bring the cost down because right now telescopes have gotten very expensive.
And that's just the ones here on Earth?
No, the one going to orbit, the James Webb Space Telescope, is costing almost $9 billion. And, well, that 15, 18 years' worth of funding for NASA building big telescopes in space. So we're down to one soon. Not now, but we will be down to one, and we need at least four or five. So how do we fix that? And there are all sorts of techniques, but in the long run, my claim is you have to use capitalism to bring the cost down, because that's what capitalism is very good at. It's a great tool.
Bravo.
So that means we have to find something valuable in space to be done. There are many things you can do in space, right? So there's tourism, I think, is going to be probably the first thing. Research labs in space, all sorts of great stuff, mining the moon. But the only thing I could help with was mining of asteroids, because to find the asteroids, you have to use telescopes and astronomical techniques. So I can actually know something about that. So I attached myself to that cause. It's a good cause because in the long run, that's where all the real wealth of the solar system lies that we can ever access.
So the idea is then that capitalism will understand that you can make money from some of the materials that may be in asteroids, bring them back and use them, and then the funding for the program will come from the profit that you make from bringing it back.
Well, it's a bit more complicated perhaps than that. What's going to happen is it's been very, very expensive to get to space, right, for 50 years. That's not something that has to be like that. It just, there haven't been any incentives to bring the cost down. If you're trying to make money out of bringing stuff back from space, you very much care about the cost, right? So
yes.
You're not going to make a trade of, perhaps I'd better do another test just in case. You'll say, that's enough. The risk is low enough. We have to go, right? Because we can't afford not to. We'll be out of business. Of course, many companies do go out of business, and that's fine because others take their place. And we're already seeing that with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Elon Musk's SpaceX rockets cost about a third of what regular traditional launch would cost.
Well, they're the group that also reused the rockets,
that's right?
Right.
And
lands, and I see that on the TV once. It's phenomenal.
They're great, yeah.
Right.
And once they perfect that technique, then they say that probably costs will come down to about one-fifth of what they've always been for the past 30, 50 years.
Okay.
And that starts to make a big difference.
But at some stage, you've got to find something up there that has value.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about these materials that I know you've been mugging up on talk to us about.
Well, the things people talk about for the short term, water, mining water from asteroids and bringing it back, not to Earth, where it's not really worth much, but in orbit, especially in a high orbit where the geostationary communication satellites are. If you take a pint of water or a liter of water up to that orbit, it currently costs you about $40,000 or $50,000.
Oh, what, a quart?
So that's kind of a stiff drink. And there aren't many things that cost that much. If you look up the most expensive bottle of wine ever, then it's about that. It gets to that sort of level.
And it's usually something that Napoleon took to Moscow
back. Or Thomas Jefferson brought from Paris or something like that.
And totally undrinkable.
Probably dreadful.
Yes, absolutely.
The whole point of that is it depends on rarity,
right.
So you can't really build a business on it.
Well, what about noble metals? I mean, that's something we hear about all the time, platinum, iridium, and so on.
Yes, platinum and palladium are very rich in some of the metal asteroids out there, and they're worth similar amounts per ton, but that's back on Earth, so that's good. Most of the platinum on Earth is actually 6,000 kilometers, 4,000 miles beneath our feet in the core of the Earth, and the same concentration process that put them there also worked in these much smaller things at the planetesimals at the beginning of the solar system. Some of those got smashed to pieces, exposing that metal core, and so that's why they were very rich. veins of platinum and palladium and so on in some asteroids.
Martin, tell us then, what are some of the materials that we do know that are out there on asteroids that we basically don't see here on Earth?
Oh, yes. Yeah, my pitch is that there are strange conditions in space when these things formed. And that means all sorts of minerals form that we see in meteorites that we don't see anywhere else on Earth. And in the long run, some of those might be like the unobtainium that was in the Avatar movies, right? That'd be incredibly valuable and worth going after. But we don't know what those are yet.
What I hear here is that in meteorites and other bits of detritus that have landed on the Earth, we've been able to see minerals that we have never seen before.
That's right, dozens of them,
Okay, so there's two features there. One is that they were originally there and came to Earth, or that there was something else that got transformed upon entry into the Earth's atmosphere at very high temperatures. Do we have those two discrete types of material?
Good question. I don't know of any that people think were formed during the entry, because that's a very brief period.
Well, let's talk about the tetratainite.
Tetratainite, yeah. There's a whole bunch here. Tetratainite is something that forms in the cooling cores, the metal cores of an asteroid. It cools at like a few degrees every million years. So it takes like 1,000 million years to become solid. And in that time, it can produce very strange minerals like tetratainite, which turns out to have very strange magnetic properties.
For example?
It's very hard to, if you put a magnetic field on it, then to change that magnetic field is very difficult. It needs a much stronger field than you, by 10 times than you would expect for any other material. So
it forms a permanent magnet easily.
Yeah.
Has it ever been synthesized on Earth? That's what I was reading about. Or is it always in this mineral? Has anybody ever done it on Earth, made some?
Yes, it has been made in the lab. That's one of the ways in which finding these minerals in space can stimulate you to say, oh, I didn't know you could do that. Yeah, let's go in the lab and make some. Because it's impossible, literally impossible, to calculate all the possible minerals. No computer could possibly do it. So it's good to have some examples.
It's an interesting point because there are many, many inorganic chemists that like to put different elements together in different ratios and different materials, and they come up with a crystal, you know, a single crystal, after an experiment that's used maybe 100 grams of material. And you say, well, what's the utility of that crystal? Well, the utility is to illustrate to people that molecules like that can exist. We don't know how to make them properly, but that, in fact, drives creative scientists. So I understand completely. We see little bits of material in meteorites on Earth, and that should stimulate, especially permanent magnets that Russell's talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, there's an incredible demand, and most of the lanthanides seem to be in China and
not readily accessible. Right. The thing about this tetratainite is it doesn't need any rare earths.
Right. It's so a nickel and iron, I think.
Yep.
Do we understand the electronic structure with theory?
I don't think so. But if you like, I'll send you a few references. And you can tell me, because it's not my field. I'm getting uncomfortable now because we're a long way from telescopes.
Okay, well, let's just go back to one of the other materials. The one I particularly liked was Lonsdaleite.
Yes.
And that was named after Kathleen Lonsdale, a famous English crystallographer, worked with Bragg. Why did they name that material after her?
I don't know.
Ah, well, I've done my homework.
You're expecting me to be a meteoriticist. I don't know.
I thought you were going to do some homework for the program.
Well, I did. I got as far as finding out where it was discovered.
Where?
The Canyon Diablo meteorite. It was found in 1966. But it was actually synthesized almost exactly the same time. But there are some people who are not sure about it. There's a paper by Shumilova et al., who I assume she's Russian, who says she isn't really convinced that this is either real or stable, if it is real.
I mean, just for the listener, and I just got this off the internet last night just to be prepared for your erudition, and it's just another form of carbon.
Yeah, right? Yes.
It's pure carbon, but in a totally different geometric structure, and named for Kathleen Lonsdale because she, in the 30s and 40s, was very active in trying to synthesize on Earth diamond. I didn't know that, and I found that a really interesting bringing it around and then giving her name an ITE at the end to designate a new mineral.
Well, and the point of this one is that it's actually, if it's real, it should be harder than diamond.
Well, that's...
Which is...
No one has yet had enough of it, is that the point?
Yeah, I think that's why it's being debated very strongly, whether it's really there or not. It's going to make it very interesting if it is.
You were here, Martin, and it's been very interesting, but we've come to the end of our allotted 28 minutes. And I just want to thank you for being at the other end of the radio and been a fascinating program. And I'm sure Russell's going to have some mot juste to finish off with.
Well, being an astronomer and so on, do you ever wonder about life on other planets? Have you got any evidence?
No evidence, but I wonder about it a lot. But that's become a real topic now, conferences and on how we're actually going to measure that. We can start to measure the atmospheres of planets around other stars now. There are some that are like almost twins of Earth. And if we could measure their atmospheres, in principle, we might be able to see signs of life. But it's tricky, because geology is a sneaky thing, and it could also produce some of these signatures temporarily. So we have to be very sure.
And it would also be, from my point of view, very improbable that there is not life out there somewhere.
I would agree.
It's so big. Yeah. We've had a lot of fun. Martin Elvis from the Smithsonian Institute at Harvard University, thank you for being here. And I'd like to thank Kimberly Garcia for putting the program together so it sounds wonderful. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.